I just kept thinking about, with everything that's available and all the resources available, why can't we find an alternative? And, you know, why isn't there an alternative? You know, tennis broadcasts have been the same for so long. The space is there, and it's a little bit more of a personal touch. You know, if I'm in the middle of a broadcast and I have to go get a cup of coffee, then, you know, 60,000 people are coming with. You know, I don't know that anyone else who's kind of the greatest of all time in their sport, you know, has kind of had to endure, and especially with her storyline and what she's overcome and where she's come from. You know, I think if it was other athletes, it would be more of a celebration more often. But Serena makes it tough sometimes. Listen, if people had eyes on you during your worst moments and your worst days on your job, you would look like a butthead too sometimes.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Bette Marston. And our guest this week is Andy Roddick, who most of you know, of course, as the former professional tennis player. Andy won the U.S. Open in 2003, multiple finalists at Wimbledon, including in just an epic match against Roger Federer, was the world number one back in 2003. I mean, a remarkable tennis career. And post-tennis career, Andy went on to work for Fox Sports 1 as a sports broadcaster, not just tennis, but doing all sports, and we'll get into that. And now he's hosting a series of broadcasts on Periscope for this year's U.S. Open tournament. And that's a big deal. It's basically the first time Periscope has been rolled into a an ad campaign, and Andy is providing a second screen experience for those who are watching the Open on a first screen, likely either ESPN or watch ESPN. So it's an interesting foray for Andy into this kind of media. And so I'm looking forward to talking to him, as well as looking forward to talking to him about his experience at Fox Sports 1, which was very interesting in that he, you know, he really could have gotten a tennis job, whether at ESPN or the BBC, but he opted to become a generalist as a sports broadcaster. And I always thought that was an interesting decision and respected it very much. All right, and as promised, we bring in Andy Roddick, who has launched, as I said at the top, into a whole new Periscope career. Andy, I've been trying to, we've been talking about this for a long time, so I appreciate you joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Yeah, I'm happy. You're a tough guy to pin down.
Yes, right. That's right, Andy. I appreciate you working into my schedule. That was very nice of you. All right, one of the things, Andy, and I've talked about, I've talked with you before about this, both for stories as well as just chatting with you over email. And one of the things I always thought was interesting is after your professional tennis career ended, you had opportunities to be strictly a tennis broadcaster, whether that would be at ESPN or the BBC or whoever does Tennis Australia. But you made a conscious decision that you wanted to do something different, and that was to be a generalist, which I really always found interesting. And I thought was very, very different than most athletes who usually and understandably go into their sport after they retire from playing. What was your thinking and reasoning behind not being strictly a tennis broadcaster and going to Fox Sports 1 to do more of generalized broadcasting?
It was a couple different things. You know, for me to retire at the U.S. Open 4 years ago, and then I just couldn't imagine myself kind of going down and doing Australia in January and then going and doing that. It just felt like kind of the same old merry-go-round a bit. So I wanted to get a little bit of space. And, you know, also with my wife, you know, kind of being out in LA a little bit, an opportunity out there probably worked a little bit better logistically than anything else. But as far as from a broadcasting standpoint, it just excited me. You know, being put live on air to cover sports that aren't really in your wheelhouse and really have to research and become well-versed in those spaces also. And I got to do live TV, which I hadn't done before, and one-on-one interviews, live podcasts, live radio, kind of all sorts of different situations. And Fox was great about letting me try out a kind of a bunch of different things, and they kind of just threw me into the fire a little bit and kind of let me learn on the job. So I think I ended up being maybe more complete as far as that stuff goes, be able to kind of roll with situations and adapt a little bit more I think it was good for me. I had a blast. I enjoyed working with everyone at Fox also. So it was a good experience for me.
Andy, did you have to convince them to take a shot on you because you did not have previous experience in these other sports? Or were they excited about having someone who obviously had a name in one big sport and then maybe they could figure out how to, for lack of a better word, teach you the mechanics of broadcasting?
Yeah, I think I felt recruited. I wasn't really actively looking for anything in a broadcasting space at that moment in my life. You know, I thought I would take maybe a couple years away from kind of the limelight. After playing and not really kind of be on TV or have anything in that sort of space and kind of just focus on other business ventures. But once I went in for my first Fox interview, I became pretty excited about it. I think at first they brought me in maybe as out of just curiosity, and then kind of on the spot they started firing questions at me about different types of sports, and I think I responded okay. And so it went from there. They were really good to work with.
And let's talk about live sports television. And you were on Fox Sports Live, which was at the time Fox's. Fox Sports' sort of attempt to be a sports center competitor.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn about live sports television in that kind of, for lack of a better phrase, sports center-like format? And you could go as long as you want on this, because I'm interested in what your observations were about the mechanics of it, how much time you feel like you had to make your point, whether it felt real, whether it felt didn't. But you're an interesting guy to ask that question of, because it was all new to you. You weren't like somebody who was coming in from some other network, and or you hadn't been on the merry-go-round of a former athlete. You literally walked into this new studio show at a relatively new network, and you were trying to take on, the biggest giant in the business.
Yeah, contrary to kind of what you hear about other networks, Fox was great about letting us have our own opinion. There wasn't really we'd sit around in the production meetings and actually that's probably what we needed the camera on. Cause I think, getting Gary Payton heated about something and letting him kind of just go off is great entertainment value. I think that's probably where the camera should have been, but it did feel rushed. I think they were trying to fit a sports center show and kind of in your home kind of best damn sports show all into the same thing, which sometimes it felt a little bit crowded. The discussion part of it felt kind of maybe rushed sometimes. The first version of Fox Sports Live, and I'm pretty sure the people behind it would still tell you that it might have been two different shows,
right?
That they were trying to combine into a shorter time period. But it was a great learning experience. I knew I was very good at being maybe on the other side of the mic and when kind of the traffic is flowing through you. But kind of having to create traffic was a different animal. And, the best broadcasters, you look at them and say, wow, that job looks easy. And that's why they're so good. There's a lot of technical things. There's a lot of cameras to look at. There's a lot of, places to stop and start without interrupting, but still being engaged. And so all of that was a pretty big learning experience for me.
Andy, in your opinion, why didn't that show work long term?
I'm not sure. It needed time. I think kind of starting at ground zero and having people, like yourself and like people who kind of cover sports media expecting a polished version the first day. I think that's a little bit, maybe the expectation was too high, but Fox was, they wanted to go big and there wasn't much time to grow. I think if something didn't work right away, they were quick to change it. And, I don't know what the special sauce is. I don't know if you have to, in the TV world, if you have to change right away, if something doesn't work, or if you give something time to develop. Unfortunately, in kind of this age of social media and kind of instant content, judgments are very quick and very, sometimes harsh and fairly and sometimes unfairly. So, I felt like we all knew we were kind of under the gun from the word go. So it felt like things changed pretty regularly, which was made it a little bit tougher to establish a rhythm.
And having been part of that, do you think someone can come in, understanding, by the way, that SportsCenter's ratings are down from their heyday in the 90s, and that young people, especially under 30, view sports highlights differently. They'll get them on social media as opposed to sitting around waiting for 11 o'clock to watch SportsCenter. But is it realistic, you think, for any show or any new network to come on and knock ESPN off? Or do you think, having been in the middle of it at Fox, that they are just too big an entity with just too big a head start to knock them off?
I wouldn't say, I would never say never. But I think your point as far as kind of the information age and kind of the age of instant gratification. I mean, we used to watch SportsCenter and actually not know what happened.
Right.
You know, now we watch it because we hear there was a great play and we want to see it with our own eyes instead of just kind of visualizing as someone else tells us in so many words. You know, the biggest threat to ESPN, I think, is live streaming, social media, kind of that instant content that they were so great at. You know, that's where you got your first look at so many things throughout our lives and throughout our kind of sports fandom. It used to be breaking news, or you'd see it on ESPN first, or, you know, that was kind of the go-to. And that paradigm is shifting very quickly with things like Twitter.
I want to get to Periscope, Andy. Later in this conversation, though, I want to ask you about sort of opinion-based sports casting and opinion-based stuff on the web, because obviously Fox has invested a lot in that, and you are interesting to talk to about that because I think you've seen it on both sides. You saw it as an athlete where you might have been the subject of that, and then you flipped over, obviously, as a broadcaster where you might actually be opining on someone. But before we get to that, let's get to Periscope, which is what you are doing now. We're taping this on Friday. I think the podcast will come out Tuesday, so that'll be the second week of the Open. You will still be doing this, and what you're doing essentially is you're providing second screen commentary. As we watch the tennis on ESPN, you are, I imagine, either at your home or at a hotel watching the matches with us, and you are letting us know why things are happening. When I watched the Serena Williams King match the other day, it was really interesting. You were diagnosing why and how Serena returns as she does, how you have to try to attack her, if that's even possible, against her serve. To me, it's just really fascinating because you're getting a pro tennis player who's won a major, in your case, has been number one in the world, giving me commentary straight into my living room. That's very interesting to me. Why did you find it particularly interesting to do this?
I love watching tennis. I'm such a fan of the game. You know, I'm not as big of a fan of kind of following the circus around as it travels throughout the world. You know, I don't feel the need to be present at every event. But I do engage in social media. I do enjoy it. And so when I was kind of thinking through what I was interested in doing, I had a great time working for BBC last year at Wimbledon. I know you have two, you have twins at home.
That's
and,
right.
I have an 11 month old boy, named Hank. And I didn't really want to be away from him for a couple weeks at a time, to kind of talk about tennis. And in my mind, it just, I just kept thinking about, with everything that's available and all the resources available, why can't we find an alternative? And, why isn't there an alternative? You know, tennis broadcasts have been the same for so long. It's almost as if it's treading water a little bit, in my opinion. So I contacted Kayvon, who's the founder of Periscope, and said, I'm an idiot when it comes to tech. You know, how do we kind of meld these two things together? I felt pretty confident in my ability to kind of go with the punches and pay attention to questions, watch tennis, digest it, and kind of go with the flow a little bit. From the work with doing a podcast and a live radio show, and so I felt well versed enough. And then doing BBC and broadcasting tennis and kind of seeing the pacing and the timing and how to do it, I felt like there was a possibility for a marriage between those two. I've done it a handful of times, so by no means am I an expert, but I think the space is there, and it's a little bit more of a personal touch. You know, if I'm in the middle of a broadcast and I have to go get a cup of coffee, then 60,000 people are coming with me, and we're just going to chat like we're like they're in my home also. So I thought there was an avenue for it, and luckily, Kayvon, the team at Periscope and the team at Twitter, thought so too, and decided to kind of take a ride with me. And they've been great partners so far. So we'll see how it shakes out.
That's interesting. So you contacted Periscope; they didn't contact you. That's pretty proactive on your part. I didn't know that.
Well, we put a tweet out, and then I said, well, maybe we should. I kind of just threw a little bait out there, and then he direct messaged me right away. The conversation went from there, and you know, it's so great because you know a little bit different than maybe being at a major network is, you know, every sales call we're on, every ideas call, you know, the founder's actually on it, and he's watching the broadcast last night and giving instant feedback. And so it's very, you know, the tech world, maybe it seems like it's a lot more involved from the top down than maybe the kind of the networks are.
Andy, what is the setup where you are? Does someone from Periscope or Twitter come to your home, set you up with whatever the camera and the equipment are, or is it really very much do it yourself? You got your laptop, you set it up, and that's that. I'm actually just curious because they've gotten a lot of press on this, so I would hope, if nothing else, that some tech person came over just to almost troubleshoot for you in case something's up.
Yeah. Well, you know, I did my first ones from Wimbledon,
right,
which kind of at that point, the only thing we were really going for, you know, they've been a great strategic partner. At Wimbledon, the first thing we were going for is say, hey, let's dabble in it. Let's do one Q&A type show and see how that goes on what was going to be the middle Sunday where there's no tennis. So we figured people would want their tennis and maybe we'd have a better chance of engaging. And then Wimbledon final, where we said, hey, let's do a live broadcast. And so at least we can put some content together to send out in case we wanted to try to get some sponsors for the U.S. Open, which we were lucky to get, Chase and Gregers, who were great partners. And so, you know, now for the U.S. Open, we got real fancy. I have like a little pod now and I can run it through my iPad. And, you know, but I'm just setting it up at home. You know, we did a shot last night where we wanted to incorporate our sponsors, and I kind of just set it up in my kitchen, and you know, they sent the tools and everything kind of they wanted and the notes on how to prepare, you know, what they were trying to get across. And you just take that information and try to apply best practices, and we just went with it. So there was last night in my house, my wife had actually driven up the road to Asheville, North Carolina with some girlfriends and the baby. So I was just solo in our house periscoping.
Nice of Brooklyn to take the baby away so you can do your tennis stuff. That's nice of her.
I think that was just a coincidence. You know, the Wimbledon broadcast, our baby was crying in the background, which people thought was humorous.
Yeah, I think I actually am a big fan of when organic stuff like that happens. I think that's very honest and like interesting viewing. What have you gotten a sense of who's periscoping you at the moment? Is it, you get the sense it's all ages, all demos, all genders, or is it, as you might intrinsically think, a lot of under 30 or a lot of millennials watching?
No, it's kind of a, you know, obviously I think the millennial generation maybe gets it and doesn't require an explanation as to what the hell I'm doing. but as far as who's tuning in, you know, a lot of it's just curiosity at this point. They're going, wait, is there another medium to kind of digest sports information? So I think there's a lot of people who are trying it out and kind of seeing if they like it. Now it's up to us to kind of provide a different type product and maybe look at some different ways to tweak it. And it's certainly still a work in progress. But, you know, I do think there's another lane for it.
Andy, have they, whether it's Periscope or Twitter, do they give you any kind of guidelines on what you can and cannot say specific to, let's say, something like cursing? Because it's very interesting to me, this field. You know, if over-the-air broadcasting obviously is monitored by the Federal Communications Commission, there are things you can't say, things you can or cannot show. Social media and streaming, it's such a sort of a new world that a lot of this stuff is still sort of being worked out. And we're not even sure what the line is. So did they, not to say that your dream or desire is to F-bomb it all over the place, but my sense is that you really can sort of say anything, I would imagine, as you are periscoping, correct? There's no, with the exception of not showing the live video that ESPN pays the rights to, right? Everything else should be up for grabs, I think.
I'm not sure that the best long-term vision is kind of saying all the words that you were referencing. You know, if I'm going on by myself, you know, I can probably say whatever I want. You know, I think different types of sponsors are looking for different types of content.
Right.
You know, and I feel like that's where I can add value a little bit. You know, I've done a traditional BBC broadcast, which is very, very buttoned up, and you know, they kind of let the silence tell the story sometimes, and it was kind of awesome to see how that worked and how it's worked for so many years. And then, you know, I've done a Fox Sports Live podcast where we do cuss and we say everything, and it's just it's kind of nuts. So you know, I kind of do like the ability to go back and forth between the two. Obviously, if it's a crazy moment late in the fifth set and you know, a very important match, and it becomes an epic semifinal at a U.S. Open, I'm not going to be cussing the whole time, because I feel like the moment deserves more respect than that. So I think there is a fine line between the two. But yeah, sure. I mean, I guess for all intents and purposes, if I wanted to do it, I could.
And have your sponsors told you what they're looking for in terms of success? Is it pure numbers? Is it a certain type of engagement where maybe like even if it's a small group stays with you for 2 hours? Have they told you what they would consider a success, which then in theory, obviously, if it's a success, they'll come back and sponsor with you again?
Yeah, not that specifically. You know, there are different terms to measure success. And obviously, network television, you kind of go after pure numbers and, you know, a rating. You know, this is a little bit different because I have the ability to talk about our sponsors a little bit more and when I want to, and if it comes up cathartically, I can actually, talk about it a little bit more, but also social media presence, how much you can get out there and how much, you know, how many views there are after the fact in videos and different sorts of things. So, it's been a fun process for me because I've learned about kind of the value of different types of mediums and how to kind of quantify dollar amounts to those values. And, you know, so on top of it being kind of a fun idea, a way for me to stay engaged in tennis also, it's been a good learning, kind of good learning lesson for me from a business perspective also.
What is the schedule like for the second week? Will you go all the way to the men's final on Sunday?
Yeah, I definitely will. You know, one of the great things is when we're talking to, you know, Periscope, the team and our partners is, I wanted that Del Potro-Johnson match to be the first one. I thought it was a standout match. Obviously, Johnson kind of touching the number one American ranking, Del Potro, night session. I was pretty sure when the schedule came out that was going to be the night match on the Thursday. You know, so, but it's the other thing that's great about Periscope is it's not like you're going to be on at 7 and then you're going to have a dud match if the draw works out that way. You can kind of pick and choose your spots a little bit better. And, you know, they've been great about working with me and kind of trusting my instincts on what matches will be interesting and kind of what's the best story to tell.
And in terms of when people want to, the best way in terms of if people want to see your commentary for an upcoming match, should they basically just need to be following you on Twitter, and then you will alert via Twitter that I'm going to be periscoping this match at whatever set time the match is?
Exactly. And we'll try to give as soon as we're kind of, I almost feel like I'm playing tennis again because I'm a little bit at the mercy of the schedule.
That's right. but
it's kind of fun that way also. Yeah. If you follow me at Andy Roddick, we'll have all the updates. As soon as I know when we're going, I'll obviously post it. And also it says whenever I do go live, on Periscope, it gives you the heads up. So, that's probably the best way to get information. You can also follow at Periscope, and they're sending updates also.
Okay, and as Andy said, his Twitter handle is basically it's his name, at Andy Roddick, all run together. When you are watching ESPN's coverage of tennis, Andy, what are you watching it the same way I would watch it, or are you listening and looking for different things?
Well, I would say that it is the same way that you're watching it, because you normally watch and look and listen for things also. You know, I enjoy really intense moments and matches. I understand they have to kind of defer to ratings and kind of the superstardom that is tennis. And, you know, Serena putting, you know, an unfortunate scoreline on another woman player. And, you know, that's not as interesting to me. Or watching Roger win 2-2-2 isn't as interesting to me as two young guys fighting in a fifth set. You know, out on one of the outer courts, and you might be able to see one of their first moments of success. That to me is a little more interesting. So I would love to see it maybe a little bit more flexible as far as jumping around between courts. But I certainly understand the business metrics, and you know, the reason you pay for broadcast rights is to get a certain rating, which leads to advertising money, and you know, so I get all that. But I do kind of like A lot of times I'll watch the, you know, I think on DirecTV it's like 701 to 7056. You can kind of pick and choose your matches. The Chase Review channel also, you can jump around to different matches. So I kind of like the flexibility to try to catch moments in the tournament as opposed to watching one match start to finish.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I do understand it too. And there are certain players, obviously, that there are certain players that ESPN is always gonna go with. Do you feel, Andy, that they do you? If you're ESPN, do you always have to try to be American centric on your coverage, or do you think at times that maybe they default if it's an American playing versus, like you said, a fantastic match on the grandstand court, or maybe you know, it's like a number 12 seed versus a number 18 seed, but those guys are not Americans. You know, one guy's a Spaniard and one guy's from the Czech Republic.
I mean, I get what you're saying. You know, I certainly appreciate it, but you go to any other country during any other slam, you know, the host broadcast of Wimbledon this year was Marcus Willis, who's a story of 800 in the world, and that's what they were playing. And if he was from some other country, there's no chance it got any love at all.
Right.
Same in Australia, same in France. You know, that's kind of the way it works. You know, I guess the parallel that I try to draw is you being in a market like New York and the Giants are playing, but there's a great game going on, so you're going to show that instead in the local market. It doesn't make any sense. And you know, listen, in a perfect world, what I would want probably isn't what's best for the network or coverage rights or advertisers or something else. So, you know, I think I understand both sides of it, but, you know, kind of having the option to, for me personally, to kind of click through different matches is fun for me, as opposed to having to watch one network and one type of coverage start to finish. It's not what I do personally.
Yeah, I agree with you, by the way. If I was Jamie Reynolds or whoever's in charge of ESPN's tennis coverage at the moment, I think you have to, if there's an American playing, especially on a semi-main court, you have to go with that first, because that's ultimately what your audience wants. I want to ask you about the BBC, because it's a fascinating, you know, when you're in London, it's phenomenally interesting to watch, or at least it's interesting to watch for me, but you've actually worked for them. So can you give me a sense of just what is it like to be a broadcaster for them, and how different did you feel it was working for them than an American broadcaster like Fox?
Well, it was different shows also. You know, BBC, it's very serious, and they welcome you in, and it's the championships at Wimbledon, and it's slow music, and it's playing, and you kind of float into the broadcast, where, you know, most things Fox covers, like, loud, in your face, next, you know, so it's just a different sort of pacing that I had to learn, and that was kind of the one thing they harped on at the BBC, which is completely foreign concept to any American sports show, is sometimes less is more. You know, you want to make sure the content of what you're saying is quality, as opposed to just feeling a need to, you know, fill silence. So I learned so much, and I only did the quarter semifinals, and I did a bunch of studio work and radio while I was over there. So it was a full 6 days when I was there last year, and I loved it. But it was a great learning experience for me, because, you know, you got kind of a different sense. And, you know, do I normally like over-the-top traditional, kind of slower? No. Did I love it then? Absolutely. For some reason, there are some events when they're covered a certain way, it just works. It's like watching the Masters. I think the weekend of the Masters is covered perfectly. I love it. I know it's coming. It's the same intro and outro every year, and I watch it every year like it's the first time I've ever seen it.
Who did you work with at the BBC? Who were the game callers that you were with?
I worked with a bunch. I did the final with Andrew Castle, who's a former player and does a lot of kind of like morning time, almost like Strahan-esque work. Yeah. You know, he's on the kind of like a morning show. It's right. A little bit more reserved than Kelly and Michael. But so he's pretty smooth as far as handling stuff. And then I did one with a couple matches with him solo. And then I did the final with Tim Henman, who, you know, is I enjoyed it, because it was, you know, the uber British guy and like kind of the uber American guy, you know, threw them together, and who knows if it would have worked or not. And I think it did. And I've always loved him, and we've always gotten along, but it was an interesting pairing that they took a chance on. And I think the results were, I think they were happy with them. So I had a blast working for them, and they do everything first class.
Where do you stand now, Andy, in terms of doing tennis broadcasting heading forward? Because as we had talked about a couple of years ago, there were some opportunities for you to go directly into this. You mentioned why you didn't want to do it. You wanted to get away. You obviously started a family. But now that we're 4 years since your retirement, have you shifted at all in terms of thinking about doing tennis broadcasting full time, or do you like the idea of just dabbling in it when you want, picking your spots?
I think picking my spots appeals to me a little bit more, and I think being maybe a bigger part of a growing space like a Periscope. You know, tennis is kind of the tip of the iceberg. It's more, we're just proving that we can do major events, and I don't see why it can't extend to other athletes or other voices and other sorts of events also. So, you know, I'd kind of rather be maybe part of something new and growing and seeing what that business model presents, as opposed to kind of going in and just being a part of something that we've all seen before.
All right, I want to finish up with a couple questions about sort of the coverage of tennis in particular, and got some pretty interesting Twitter questions for you. But you're someone now who can see the game from outside, as opposed to when you were inside the game and had the viewpoint that way. When you look at the coverage of Serena Williams, Andy, over, let's say, the last decade, I would like to intentionally make this open-ended. How have you seen it in regards to fairness, in regards to volume? I'd be very curious to how you've seen the easily the most famous American tennis player that exists today. What do you think the coverage has been, the media coverage has been of her?
I think it's been a little unfair at times. You know, I don't know that anyone else who's kind of the greatest of all time in their sport, you know, has kind of had to endure, and especially with her storyline and what she's overcome and where she's come from. You know, I think if it was other athletes, it would be more of a celebration more often. But Serena makes it tough sometimes. And I mean, we're great friends since we're young. And so, you know, I have no problem saying this. And we were actually I remember us being in Brooke and I's kitchen with her last year after the season was over. It was a couple months after the Open. And, you know, she's tough. You know, she doesn't give the media much if she's in an upset mood or if she's lost. And, you know, so it is a little bit different. I think she's done a great job this year. I think she was very gracious after the Australian Open when she was upset there. I think she's, you know, been a little gentler this season, even though it hasn't been as successful as last season. And maybe there's less stress in that. But, you know, I think a lot of the qualities that we see in her being very demonstrative on court, yelling, getting upset at an umpire, you know, being uber competitive. Those are all things that when I'm talking to people, they give me credit for when I'm removed from my career, they kind of laugh it off and you broke stuff. And with Serena, there's a little bit of a different tone about it. And, you know, I'm not sure if it's, you know, a man woman thing or what it is, but, you know, I think it's finally settling in. And I think kind of the stats she's able to put up and, I feel like there's a little bit more of an embracing nature with the way they're calling her now, which I think has been a long time coming.
I want to ask you two things about that, because you said some very interesting things there. One, I've probably been in maybe 100 Serena Williams press conferences during my years of covering the Open. I've only done one-on-one with her maybe once, but I've been in 100 of these, and you hit on something that I think is dead on. There are times when Serena Williams can be the most charming person in the room if she is in the mood to talk to the press. And then there are other times, as you said, we're talking one-word answers where the tension in the room is through the roof. Do you have any sense? I'd love to ask Serena this, but do you have any sense of why that is? Is it because after a while doing 5,000 press conferences, it becomes rote? Or does she want to keep her edge? Or is it something else that is just akin to her particular personality?
Yeah, I mean, the only problem with that question is you want me to commit fully to one of those.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, and I'm not sure that that's the case. You know, I think she's always been, you know, a little bit wary of people for good reason. You know, kind of with her history and coming from Compton and being in the world of tennis and, you know, since the age of 14, people wanting something from her.
Right.
I think she's rightfully a little more guarded. You know, I'm lucky enough that I've seen kind of behind the window, and we were able to establish a friendship and a trust from a young age. So, you know, the Serena Williams that I see, you know, when socially or when she's in Austin to come to our house and hang out with us and, you know, see the baby and is just smiley and jovial and kind of laid back. And there's no worry, you know, she doesn't have to worry about someone catching something she says or, you know, taking it out of context or being kind of this lightning rod, you know, socially or, you know, whatever else it is. And she's the most lovely person you'll ever be around, you know, and with a great personality and every, you know. But listen, if people had eyes on you during your worst moments and your worst days on your job, you would look like a butthead too sometimes.
Right.
It's just the nature of sports. And I know some people are great at dealing with it or at least, you know, kind of hiding or masking their anger. And, you know, she's probably not as good as that. But, you know, we, you know, neither was Michael Jordan. He broke a teammate's nose in practice one time and we celebrate it, you know? So it's a different deal sometimes with the way we cover her for some reason.
Yeah. That's well said in gender. And I think you're totally right. It's well worth it for people in the press to think about, like, imagine the cameras in your face every time you screwed up, you know, on this podcast. I think we just screwed up. We lost you earlier when we dropped you on the phone line. So that would, you know, that would not be a fun moment to have TMZ in my face asking me about that.
Sure.
One last thing about Serena, though, Andy. And again, I don't know. I know there's no per se correct or perfect answer on this, but I do want to ask you this as an observer. How much do you think how we have covered her, I say we collectively as the media over the last 10 years, has to do with the fact that she's not just a woman, but she's Black? And do you think the coverage would be different if Serena Williams was white and everything else about her is the same?
I don't know. I mean, I guess my only counter to that was we've celebrated a lot of Black athletes this year. I probably put more stock in how you cover this dominant force of a woman who is pop culturally relevant, who sometimes has an attitude. And let's face it, the media have egos too, you know. So if one time you're in a press conference and you are very urgent and you think you have a great story, but you can't actually get access because she's pissed off that day, the result isn't going to be very good. You know, they're going to get their feelings hurt and they're going to write something and that's their game. You know, if she wants to kind of deal that way, then, you know, she has to deal with the fallout. And I think she understands that. You know, but I don't like getting into that too much because I think each case is different. So I think it's tough to paint those deeper, very important issues with a broad brush. I think that's where people get in trouble sometimes.
Fair enough. You were someone who could be critical of the media during your playing career. And I wonder, you know, one of the things that was interesting about being in press conferences with you would be that you always answered questions, but there were certainly times that you made it very clear when you thought a question sucked or when you were particularly pissed off at a particular reporter for whatever reason. Did you find that was a maturation process for you? You had success very early, obviously, early 20s. I guess it's my long-winded way of asking, what was the journey and process like for you to be used to being interviewed as much as you were interviewed, particularly at majors when it was, you know, every day after multiple matches and sometimes one-on-ones if you had great success at that tournament?
Yeah, I guess I just saw it as an even playing field. You know, when I was a player, you all came in press conferences. You wanted me to be fair. You wanted me to answer your questions. I expected myself to be prepared to provide access, which I always did. Conversely, I wanted the journalists to be well-read also. You know, if they're referencing something that actually wasn't factual, you know, mispronouncing terms in tennis because they were too lazy to actually study the game, then I wasn't that happy with it. Or if I felt like a journalist had a story written before I actually answered their question and my answer didn't fit into the context of what they wanted to write, then they would kind of ask it a different way.
Right.
That would bother me. You know, I wanted the story written on the basis as a reaction to my responses, as opposed to kind of having it and lazily mailing it in, dealing with the topical 5 or 10% of an issue and not actually having a conversation about it. So, I don't really regret challenging the media. You know, I think that's fair. And I think a lot of the people, they may not have liked me at times throughout my career, but I think at the end, when I retired, there was always a firm handshake, a look in the eye with a lot of the media and say, hey, you know what, that was a pretty fun run. And you kind of end up smiling about the times where you didn't quite get along. But I think they would always tell you that I was fair. You know, I if I had an issue, I would seek them out and talk to them about it. It wouldn't be the thing where I didn't say anything and I would just ice them out forever. So I think it was fair game, and I felt like I was allowed to respond also.
Was there one particular moment in your career where you would say was sort of the toughest moment for you with the media? And if so, what was that?
Not really. The parts where I got maybe frustrated sometimes is when people who maybe specialize in a sport were forced to cover tennis, and therefore they made a very kind of lazy attempt at it and weren't really factual with stuff. And when I felt like it was lazy journalism, that probably bothered me the most. It was probably rare that if I played horribly or had a terrible loss, that someone said it before I did. I guess I just wanted to know that professionalism ran both ways.
All right, we're going to finish up here with Andy Roddick, who's been generous with his time. We think about this. Andy, I should say we thank him for that. One last thing, sort of in terms of being a media subject, that when I had you on, I did want to ask you about, because it's not going to be the case for myself or for my producer, Bette Marston, and that is,
sure,
what happens or what is it like to deal with when you're no longer just covered per se by the sports press, and that the, for lack of a better phrase, the entertainment press starts covering you, whether it was, before you married Brooklyn, you obviously dated some people who were well-known, and then you obviously married a Sports Illustrated model who then became an actress. So that puts you into not just Sports Illustrated and ESPN.com, that puts you into TMZ and Us Weekly, et cetera. Was that an adjustment for you, and what was that like when you started getting covered from places that were the exact opposite of traditional sports places?
I guess it was a little different. Most of the coverage you get is normally fallout from your decisions and your actions. I think athletes forget that sometimes. They want everything, and they want to be seen, and they want to do this, but they don't want to deal with the fallout of those actions. I think I always had a pretty good balance of, kind of I chose to do, I remember I won the Open. I chose to do everything afterwards.
Right.
For different reasons, for business reasons. And, it was pretty calculated. I did Saturday Night Live. So then that's outside of the tennis space. And I did a lot of things purposely outside of the tennis space. So when you start getting covered outside of the tennis space, you can't really complain about it. So I think I had that understanding and was aware of the benefit of that also. So you didn't hear me really complain too much about the bad stuff that came along with it also.
Two last ones for me. First off is, can you sort of put into perspective how lucky both tennis fans and particularly the tennis media have been by having people like Roger, Rafa, and Novak, who are and Andy Murray too, who really are incredibly honest with the press as four people who are among the greatest of all time. I feel like and I think the people who really cover the sport and know the sport would say this and respect it, but the era of those four guys in particular, and probably Roger and Rafa in particular, you may never again get guys who are that great who are also that great with the press. It just does not happen in most sports, and I think the tennis media has been, to a certain extent, maybe spoiled by that. Would you agree, and particularly with Federer, who is maybe the best... maybe the best athlete I've ever seen who is that good at his job?
Yeah, and it's funny, as you were kind of going through that question, it made me think back to Serena also. If those guys are being that way with the press, and even in their worst moments are able to kind of treat it a different way, that probably, maybe that's part of the coverage also.
Good
but,
point, yep.
I think those guys, you run out of superlatives at the end of the day, but I think they're very good at kind of realizing their place in the game. I think they take that responsibility very, very seriously. Before them, it was probably more of a selfish nature as far as players with the media. If you look at it, it's funny because you look at Mac with the media, now he's like the guy that's been around,
right,
kind of working the media for forever, and how things change. And, I was obviously surlier, and Courier was the same way. And, Pete was, very focused and didn't really want to have time. He didn't need to be covered. He didn't kind of feel the need for attention. He figured winning would do that. So it is a different generation. But I think the thing that is most fortunate with those guys being so great and kind of understanding of their responsibilities and how they can affect the game, is that it took place in the biggest lull as far as Grand Slams with Americans ever. You know, if all of a sudden we don't have guys who can promote the game, who don't carry night sessions at the U.S. Open, who don't rate when they're playing Wimbledon finals, and we don't have those guys, it could have been a serious problem. And I think we owe, you see the roof build at the U.S. Open, you see all these great things being built. Without an American being ranked number one in the world, I think a lot of credit has to go to those guys.
Yeah, for sure. And then finally, Andy, let me know if I'm right about this, but am I correct that Brooklyn has you beat on Sports Illustrated covers 1-0, or is my math off on that?
That's true. When I won the Open, I guess they thought I'd win more because they put the offensive or defensive lineman from the Bills on, like, running a fumble back, and I was, like, in a very – technically, I was on the cover. It just wasn't very big.
That's right. I remember – yeah, one of the reporters working on that story, I remember that, and I thought to myself – once again, why are we putting the NFL on the cover? An American just won the U.S. Open. But it was always a tough go with tennis. Listen, Andy, we'll be watching Periscope. And again, like I've told you before, I think it's a really, really cool thing. And I think you are at the beginning of something big. Those who have jumped on Periscope, even my best friend Clay Travis, I have to give credit to. I think this is clearly the future, because it's – you can't beat the engagement of basically somebody being in your home with you. And if it's a second screen experience like yours, explaining what I'm watching, or if it's just, the ability to basically just have a conversation with somebody at any time of the day and not needing a cable subscription or anything like that. So I'm glad you're doing it. And I would imagine if you enjoy doing it, there's going to be far more opportunities both within tennis and outside of tennis. So I hope you keep it up, because Bet and I have enjoyed at least watching it early on, and we'll definitely be watching it as this tournament gets deeper and more interesting. So thanks very much for being on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, and I imagine our paths will cross in the future again.
All right, Richard. Look forward to seeing you. Thanks for having me on.
All right, back in the studio as we wrap up with Bet Marston. Bet, my thanks to Andy Roddick, who is really interesting, and no surprise that he was. Something Andy said that was really interesting, and we probably could have done an hour on this, is his thoughts on Serena. He obviously has known her a long time. They are friends. He gave you some insight into Serena when she goes to visit Brooklyn Decker and Andy and their new baby. But he is correct, and I try to be a very open-minded sports media person, but I'm sure I'm guilty of this too, that you really don't ever sort of think enough about how often the camera is in Serena's face or how often she is covered. And not to excuse her when she could be a pain in the butt in press conferences, but you do get it. When basically, since you're the age of 14, someone wants something from you, that has to basically ultimately impact sort of how you view, how you view the world, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, people certainly... When Serena's in the public all of the time,
right.
And sure, she puts herself out there a little bit, but she gets pressed whether she likes it or not, and it's kind of obvious that she clearly doesn't like it sometimes, and it just kind of reminds you that big famous athletes like this are human as well. If think about it, if you wouldn't want a camera in your face all the time tracking your every move, you can't even go to an airport without people knowing who you are, and Serena's the same exact way. I mean, she gets upset when she said before that she hates losing, and people, so do most people. Like, it just shows that they're athletes are just like you and I, Richard.
Well, I don't know if they're just like, they're like you and I in some cases, but the thing with Serena though is, and you have to keep it in mind, I mean, Serena Williams introduced Beyonce the other day at the VMAs. Think of just how big an athlete you have to be to sort of be put into that spot where people are like, this is really cool. And she and Beyonce are very similar in terms of women empowerment and sort of what they represent. I mean, that's a big time athlete, not just your average athlete.
The best thing about that was, I forget where I read this or where I heard this. It must have been on part of the ESPN's US Open coverage, one of the shows where Serena was like, oh yeah, I texted Beyonce. And I was like, what, you texted Beyonce? I mean, there's got to be a handful of people in this world who can say that they've are on texting terms with Beyonce.
Right. And neither of them are in this room taping this podcast.
Definitely.
All right. Thanks to Andy Roddick. The Periscope thing is cool. Bet, I don't know if you've checked it out. You will check it out. But he, he's a good tennis analyst, and that makes the difference. I don't think, interestingly enough, I'm not even kissing his ass because he's on the podcast because he's gone now. But if that was another analyst who's not as good as dissecting tennis, it wouldn't work because you don't have the value of the pictures in front of you. Mm-hmm. So you really need someone who knows like what they're talking about, who could sort of help you have a more enjoyable experience as a tennis viewer. And he's very good. If it was a middle-of-the-road tennis analyst, those Periscope stuff would suck.
Absolutely. Andy understands the medium as well. He understands, you know, how to get the most out of his Periscope audience, how to best engage a Periscope audience. He was saying, you know, if...
Why aren't we doing this, by the way?
I don't know. I'm not dressed to be on camera. Are you dressed to be on camera?
No, certainly not today.
Exactly. So Andy was saying how
I'm not sure Andy's so dressed to be on camera either. If you've seen the Periscope, he's just like hanging out in his house.
Andy is a very good-looking person. I don't know if you realize that. Two things about Andy.
I haven't really spent much time thinking about it.
Two things about Andy. He said that you know, he was explaining how, you know, if I want to go get a cup of coffee, my viewers are coming with me to get a cup of coffee.
Right.
And that type of insight is what people like to see. I mean, as opposed to like a very buttoned up, stuffy. Right.
You like the authenticity of that.
Yes, the authenticity of it is exceptional.
Exceptional.
And Andy is also very good at not dumbing down, but like explaining right. tennis layman, for a layman.
Layman and lame women's term, sort of, he can bring it to the average tennis yes. fans audience.
He's very smart at explaining tennis for the layperson and making it interesting for someone who may not be the most excited about tennis. Deitch, you and I both really enjoy right. tennis, so we would probably watch it no matter what.
Right, right.
But, you know, there are people out there who couldn't care about tennis any less than, you know, they might make
Well, I think you
got
to be a tennis
Andy.
Fan, I think, to sort of take the Periscope, don't you think? That's you gotta not maybe the hardest hardcore, but you gotta
it's
be
a different
you,
medium.
You gotta be a, you gotta be a semi hardcore fan to be watching Andy Roddick's Periscope describing you the Open. You gotta be watching the Open.
Yeah, okay, I guess you're right because it is a second screen experience. Right. So,
all right. What have we learned, Ben? We've learned that we've learned that the outro to this podcast is longer than the last 15.
Deitch, I haven't taped your podcast in like a month, so I have a lot of thoughts.
You've had a lot to say, Ben, and then we need to end it now. All right. Bette Marston, of course, we thank you. We thank Andy Roddick, our guest. We thank Ben Eagle, Ryan Hunt, John Wertheim, and Chris Stone. How about those four? All right. So for my producer, Bette Marston, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.